Hey everybody, kick this off here. So I'm Kiefer Zhang. I'm a consultant at Economics Design. I'm particularly interested in and focused on the gaming side of things, but been in the crypto space since 2014 and professionally since 2018, originally doing some systems design for a crypto racing game. Then hopped over to a company building out some crypto casinos and exchanges, basically doing incentive design and statistical work for them, starting to get the things together with understanding what motivates people and how to design different sorts of token models for different types of systems. And now I've been at Economics Design for about a year and three quarters now, and working with teams across all different sectors of Web3 and figuring out how to design sustainable economies.
Awesome. Just to get started, how was GDC? You were at GDC.
It was a great experience. It was my first GDC actually, but from what I heard from others comparatively to other to past ones, there's strong Web3 presence and also higher quality, and from my experience, that lined up really well. I met a lot of amazing people, got a chance to get better connections IRL with people that I've spent a fair amount of time speaking with virtually. And overall, it's got me feeling very good about where the space is going in terms of the talent and the depth of thought people are giving to integrating Web3 in the gaming space. And overall, definitely enjoyed that experience.
Nice. And are people still talking about NFTs? Are people talking about hard currency, soft currency, stable coins? Any general things that keeps everyone interested?
See, I don't know if we got too deep into different types of monetization conversations with most of the people, or enough to get a pulse on the space, specifically at the conference. I think there's a lot of, or at this point, a lot of people taking a kind of web 2.5 route and looking at how to kind of casually integrate some Web3 monetization methods without diving in too deeply on that. But as we progress, definitely talk to some teams that are really thinking about a full Web3 route as well and pushing the potential of what blockchain can do. For example, talk to a team called Curio that's building out fully on-chain games. And yeah, perhaps that's something we can dig into a little bit more in the space. But so it's a little bit of a mix. Some people are going a little bit more slowly into the space, dipping their toes in, and others are really starting to do the hard thinking about what the full potential of this is.
Well, that helps us to segue into our topic of today, which is a nice segue. And we want to understand the building blocks of game economics. So we look at mechanism, constraints, and innovation. So what we get, let's get started with the question that I get a lot. Are there any games that you have played with that you think have particularly effective in-game economies? And what makes them so effective?
Yeah, and so some of the there's some really interesting ones out there that I'll lean towards some that have sort of Web3 like or close to Web3 aspects that I find interesting, but are definitely not Web3 games. And so some that have very complex economies include like EVE Online, where what interests me there is that they have this complex supply chain, essentially, where everyone has a role in the economy. And so it's not everyone doing the exact same things, and you're able to specialize and find where you fit in, what you enjoy doing, the problems that you like solving, and the kind of gameplay you want. And so you could be at kind of the bottom of the supply chain mining resources. You can be in thinking about transportation, you can think about different types of crafting, building, all the way up to having the ships themselves, which are then which people buy in order to wage large scale wars against each other. And at that higher level, it's providing kind of recurring demand for those ships, and therefore all the that kind of floats all the way down to creating to propping up this whole supply chain and allowing people to and creating the demand for all these other components there. That I think is a model that is interesting to consider as we look at more complex economies with real value behind them in Web3, and making sure that if you are talking about a complex supply chain-like economy, that at the top of it, you're really considering where the demand is coming from. And is that demand reoccurring from the same player base? Or is it likely problematically reliant upon a continual growth in user base? And then in terms of other game economies, one that has a special place in my heart is Team Fortress 2. Spent a very, very large amount of time playing and trading different types of items, mostly hats, from Team Fortress 2. And one of the things that I liked about the way that their economy was designed was that, or some of their systems in general were designed in a way to create positive externalities. For example, they had a gifting mechanic as one of their monetization strategies, and they were just, and the way they got to the decision of wanting to implement that was just thinking about what are the things that you can do, what are the kinds of systems you can create that are going to make other people happy. And so they're able to sell gifts or gift wrap, and try to spur demand for that, potentially through seasonal events. Obviously, Christmas is a pretty easy one there. But in doing so, you're kind of stimulating purchasing in your economy, but it's not just for the benefit of that individual person, but there's some gift recipient at the end of this too. And so you're creating systems that are kind of both like spurring demand and helping monetization, but also improving the experience of people who aren't even directly a part of that transaction. And then for the more overall structure for their monetization, they use a crate and key system. So basically like a loot box. It's similar to CSGO, that have this fixed cost of keys to open this up and get some sort of cosmetic from it. Yeah, and then in this system, you have this level of randomization and high cosmetic focus, but it has a very vibrant trading economy around it. Sort of interesting example of where there's no default currency imposed by or built in the game. There's no obviously no token, but no very fungible currency. And so at different times, different assets within the economy were adopted as currency. Most common of those was keys, but at other times there's like the Bill's hat, there were earbuds, just certain things that were common enough and not necessarily common enough, but some of the old ones were restricted supply or just had very standardized floor pricing to them that allowed them to be viable as a currency. And so it shows that people are able to adapt and change and create this kind of peer-to-peer economy even when there isn't necessarily a currency provided for them.
So it sounds like a lot of these games, they have a lot of different components, parameters, a lot of different kind of asset types, utility, use cases that create a very complex economy. It's not as straightforward as this is a currency. You use the currency for everything in the game. You have keys, you have other assets, and they all commingle together to create a very robust economy. So before we move on, I also want to introduce Rob, who's also an economic design. And Rob, do you want to introduce yourself? And then we can also ask you the same question.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Lisa. So I'm the newest member of the team here. I come to economics design from a more traditional Web2 background. I've been in the gaming industry for a number of years, launched a number of mobile and social games throughout my career. And over the last couple of years, I've been very enamored and kind of deeply entrenched into Web3. I did a token launch on Pioneers Chain a year and a half ago, and more recently worked with Splinterlands on their upcoming tower defense game. So a bit of background there. And Lisa, what was the question that you wanted to pose?
Yeah, so thank you for sharing that. the question I asked people was, are there any games that you've played where you think they're particularly effective in-game economies? And why are they effective? And people were sharing from a Web3 perspective. Would you like to share it from a Web3 perspective or Web2, since you've been in the gaming space for almost 20 years?
Well, I think, you know, it's hard to talk about game economies, particularly on the Web2 side, and not talk about EVE Online. I think what they've built out there is particularly, you know, it's amazing. They have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people spending money to really build these, you know, massive industries. They have people that are, you know, focused on mining, focused on actual refinement, focused on building, and all of these things are kind of interconnected and really not run by the company itself, not run by CCP, which is the company that made online. They basically just kind of threw all of this out there and let the community build and create and really, you know, make a virtual world for themselves. And it's been somewhat amazing to see what people will actually do with those experiences and with the, you know, the world they put out there. I know over time they have had these immense wars where people would actually go in and you'd have epic battles with giant ships. And I know that quite often they would, estimates would be that these battles cost upwards of $300,000 of real world money when all of the dust had kind of settled, you know, the ships that were destroyed, all of the damage that was done. You know, this was taking very, you know, real money out of people's hands for this experience. So I think in terms of an economy that I'm very impressed with, I would say it's that EVE Online.
I agree with you. And I'm very excited to see EVE Online coming to the Web3 space as well.
I think it's going to be very impressive.
Yes. I'm very excited to see how they're going to develop and grow that, because EVE Online gets very, very complex. And by allowing it to move into Web3, it bridges between the Web2 and Web3 world, and allowing all these, you know, $300,000 for a battle becomes a lot more real when you have the interoperability. So now let's dive deeper into all the various mechanisms and mechanics before we move forward. So a lot of monetization just now, a lot of conversations about that. How do you think game developers should balance the need to generate revenue with the need to keep players engaged and satisfied?
Yeah, so kind of what comes to mind first here with engagement is having a low barrier to entry being important here. That's kind of why we've seen a lot of success with free-to-play models. And because the how engaged a player is going to be and willingness to pay, it's going to change depending on where they're at and kind of the how far they've progressed through it. If you're trying to monetize that user beforehand, before they've actually played any of the game, it's going to be a little bit of a harder sell. And so just really thinking of that's what can kind of have a split between more premium and more free to play, longer tail of monetization for users. But yeah, I would love Rob's take on this.
I think, yeah, kind of shifting, you know, I spoke earlier on the Web 2 stuff. I think looking at Web 3, I think we've definitely seen a kind of a shift in the mechanics that game developers can make use of. You know, obviously you take a look at a game like Axie, where you have this tremendous barrier to entry to be able to get in there and play the game. The you know, the Axie ended up being hundreds of dollars, and that was the minimum requirement. You had to have one of those to really get in there and start playing the game. And I think that, you know, last year and for the last couple of years, that mechanic may have worked well, as there was a lot of hype in the industry and a lot of money coming in there. But now, as things have cooled off a little bit and we're kind of seeing a shift more towards kind of more good mechanics behind games as opposed to that high investor class of player, I think developers really need to look at what is that onboarding experience. So, you know, rather than having to spend $300 to buy an NFT, it's, you know, maybe a good first time user experience where I can come in there without having to do any kind of investment into the game and, you know, see what the game mechanics are. See if I like the style of game. I like the art. I like the core game loops. And then maybe I want to do an investment beyond that. And that's where you can start to bring users in there to monetize and to start raising revenue for the game. I think what a lot of Web3 developers are starting to discover now is that it is fairly expensive to acquire users. You know, it can, I know in Web 2, quite often you'd be paying $15 for each user that you tried to bring on. Then in the casino side, it can be upwards of $100 to bring in a good user. And I think Web3 developers are starting to see these expenses as, you know, finding a community to grow is not necessarily as organic as it used to be. So I think that if you put those real heavy friction points in there at the beginning, so that before you even play the game, you have to make a purchase, you have to put money forth into the game, that's going to be a lot of friction. It probably prevent a lot of new users from coming in and experiencing the game.
I love this conclusion because I think that's a big shift in where we are in Web3 gaming today. Previously, in the previous bull cycle, gaming or non-gaming, even DeFi, everyone looked at tokens as a way of easy user acquisition, as you mentioned, Rob, because user acquisition gets a lot more expensive these days. But the conversation now is moving toward how do we retain these users? If user acquisition becomes so cheap, all I do is just keep giving out tokens, people are not going to stay. People are just going to move on to the next shiny thing. And this is very important because the game mechanics, the economy, the building blocks of the economy is not just about attracting people there to the game, but how can people stay in the game, play the game, and monetization is not just about generating revenue. It's not just by new users coming in, but also people staying in the game. If the monetization or generating revenue is only about people coming in, let's just pawn this game with extra stats.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're using the financial Web3 components, if the main focus on your distribution there is user acquisition, then you got to think about the quality of the users you're getting in. Because maybe you, quantitatively speaking, you can get a high number of users by offering the different financial rewards. But if at the end of the day, your revenue is driven by whale spending for enjoyment of the game, nothing financial related, then those are not really the users you're going to attract through that strategy. But thinking about it from more of a retention perspective is, I think, a lot stronger of a value proposition for these different types of Web3 incentives. Thinking about, okay, these are the whales that are really adding value, thinking a bit more like a casino VIP program where you're giving all these perks to those that are really driving revenue or driving other key metrics to the project.
Rob, do you want to add something first?
I was just going to say, you know, I think one of the most cliche things that people say is make a good game, make a game that people really enjoy.
Yeah.
I think if it was that easy, then everyone. But there is some underlying truth in there in that, you know, as long as you have to make something that people want to enjoy, you know, even this game as simple as some of the hyper casual games that you see out there, where it's basically you press a button and then you come back 5 hours later and you collect all of the rewards that you dug up from your idle miner game. As long as people are enjoying that experience, they will keep coming back. But if there's really nothing in there that is pleasing to the player and makes them want to come back, then there's not a heck of a lot that a developer can do to really work on that retention.
That reminds me a lot of business game about maybe 1.5 years ago called Cravada. And all you do is just go in, stick something, and you do nothing. It's an idle game. It just makes so much. And people rushed in for maybe a couple of weeks, cash everything out, and then left the game. So
there was a game called Cookie Clicker that you would just basically go in there and you tap a cookie, and like chocolate chips would fall out of it. And that was the whole game, and it was very popular. I loved clicking on the cookie.
Yeah. So when teams have to think how they're adapting monetization. And so it can be fine to take the existing concept or project that people do like, you idle clicker games potentially, but you have to think about, okay, if you're taking this concept from Web 2, what is the monetization strategy for it? A lot of these casual or hyper casual games, it is getting a little bit harder in the current ad landscape, but generally the monetization focus there is based around ads. And so if you're trying to adapt that to Web3, but you have this expectation that people are going to be paying for something of like, okay, people will buy cosmetics in our Web3 game, that's our monetization strategy. And you look at the Web2 equivalents for the same genre and they're all going based on advertising, It's probably because people aren't paying for cosmetics in the Web2 version. And so now you're thinking, okay, so why are people actually buying these NFTs? Probably purely for the financial speculation component of it, and potentially with some of these old versions to get the Ponzi-like financial incentives from it. And so if you strip out any blockchain incentives, NFTs or tokens from an underlying product, and this applies to less game focused things as well, like Steppen, then if the monetization strategy wouldn't really align with the actual purchase of these assets like cosmetics, then they're probably just doing it. They're probably just purchasing it for the financial component. You don't really have a sustainable revenue stream.
So that's a very good point that I want to bring up as well and focus on, actually, because we talk a lot about mechanism and we can talk about good mechanisms and bad mechanisms, but it all boils down to the different kind of game genre or different kind of constraints in place. So do you think that there are any particular games or genres that's especially suited for in-game economies? You mentioned about game economies where it's based on ads versus game economies that's based on whale spending and enjoying the game. Are there certain kind of genres we should take note of?
Well, I think you look at games like Ebony or Game of War, these kind of RPG battle games, where you're going in there and you're building an empire, you're building an army, and then you go out and attack other people. I think those type of games, I haven't seen one done very well yet in Web3. Those were extremely popular in Web2. And I think that idea of having a ton of different resources that you would need to collect, build mines, go out, chop trees, all of that type of stuff, and bringing the additional layer of a token economy on top of that, where, you know, maybe your civilization is generating these resources and you can burn off some of your resources to generate more of the token for your empire. And then those tokens are, you know, it could be a governance token that allows you more voting control in the empire. I think those type of mechanics, I would love to see more of that kind of big economy, you know, lots of different moving pieces, lots of flywheels going, that are all very complicated to keep track of, but really make for a very deep and complex game. Those are the type of games that I really enjoy playing, and I think that it would lend itself very well to that Web3 economy.
And building on that, I kind of generally grand strategy or survival, things where there's some inherent conflict and asset destruction, I think can make a lot of sense. Again, tying back to that point with EVE Online, where if you have these complex economies, but at the end of it, or say at the top of the supply chain, there has to be some reoccurring demand from the same users. And so if the assets that they buy have permanent economic relevance, then in order to keep driving demand, you have to continually get new users. But that's not sustainable. So you have to think about how are you potentially monetizing those users over time. And when you're talking about an economy that's based around kind of creation or collection of resources, crafting of some sort, and creation of the end asset, probably that end asset needs to not be permanently relevant, be destroyed, and have some in-game reason to be destroyed. And so those kind of survival and grand strategy, there's some level of conflict, gives that story and that reason for that mechanic to exist.
So building a game reminds me a lot of like building a country and the governing economic policies and laws around a country. The repeatability of users playing the game and having intrinsic demand of whatever that's going on in the game. It's very similar to people mandating your citizens to pay income taxes. And that allows people to, it's a repeated activity that people need to do, and they need to do something within the economy, some form of fundamental demand driver of the economy so that you can pay taxes, and that helps to support the demand of the asset. So one of the things that countries do is that they get feedback by your community, from your country through voting and things like that. And from a game developer's perspective, that is getting feedback from users to update the in-game economy design. So how do you think developers can incorporate those user feedback, especially design and economy is a live thing. You can't just put it there, let it flourish and organize itself. Gotta listen to feedback by people. How can we incorporate that?
Well, I know one of the interesting things that we saw with Splinterlands was the amount of community voting that they put out there. And basically your votes were tied to the amount of token that you had in the ecosystem. So, they really encouraged the holders of the game, the people that were very engaged with the game, to be active in choosing what the direction of different activities, different future development plans, that type of thing. They encouraged them to go out there and do these votes to really focus on that. And I think that that's kind of an interesting analogy to the real world, where you encourage people to go out there and vote for their elected leaders, vote for their ballot initiatives, that type of thing, at least here in the U.S. But we see that, particularly in the Splinterlands ecosystem, where they were, really very community focused and listened to what their players wanted. So I think that type of voting mechanic from the real world is brought into the games. Definitely did not see much of that in previous genres of games, but I think with Web3, there's a lot more opportunity for that. And I think developers can carefully use that mechanic to really engage the community and come up with ideas that maybe they didn't really think of.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And so it is useful to listen to the community. I think of it as like a temperature check. And different communities or different projects are going to have different ranges of decentralization, but it's not without its potential pitfalls as well, because different users might have different motivations, and there can be, in a lot of cases, a financial incentive to try to put something forward that would give some direct financial benefit to a particular user or group. And so it could be a situation where if you're basing voting power on the essentially on financial metrics, you can have the rich get richer kind of trend over time. And if you're talking about game balance, you might have people trying to make changes that give them sort of a unique advantage over the competition, or something that will impact them in a positively in a financial way. And on the economy side, there is different people have different motivations for why they would want a certain change to go through. And so you just have to be very careful with what power you give over and what checks and balances are in place to prevent someone from making changes that are very detrimental to the long-term success of the project. So in terms of how this can be structured, for projects that want to make sure that the decision-making is in the hands of those that are a bit separated, a bit better, have maybe a stronger background, for example, if the focus is on economy changes for a DAO, you could have a council-based system where you're voting in essentially this central bank group of a few people that are making these ongoing decisions about the economy, that probably have a background in economics, that might know a little bit more about the implications of a decision relative to the wider community, versus the structure where the community itself or all DAO members are in participating in direct democracy to vote on each major decision. And so, yeah, it's definitely, I definitely like the Web3 ethos of involving the community more, taking that feedback, and at times having that direct control, but have to be aware when structuring this that there can be pitfalls depending on the particular situation.
That's a great point.
I think almost like every game should have an economic council where people just only focus on the economy, and then you have an operation council or treasury council and things like that. But games should consider and take economies more seriously and have a group of economists just focusing on improving the economy. That's it. Okay, so we mentioned that today we'll speak about three topics: mechanics, constraints, and innovation. We spoke about mechanics and constraints so far. In mechanics, we talked a little bit about good games, why they're good, why they're effective, what are the mechanisms leading to that. And we discussed about the difference between the mechanics of user acquisition and user retention. And we said that we now should focus a little bit more on user retention and not just look at monetization from a user acquisition perspective. In the constraints, we talk a little bit about the game genres, as well as how do we incorporate the update of the game economy, and how do we balance between what is right, what is decentralized, how decentralized should we be. So with the last few 15 minutes, I really want to focus more on innovation, because I think Web3 is all about innovation, and Web3 is about taking not just technical innovation, but also economic innovation. So here's the question. In your opinion, some innovative game mechanics that you've seen in modern games?
So there was a game that I was a big fan of that came out middle of last year called Void Runners. It is not, unfortunately, it hasn't seen as much success as I think it deserves. I think it was a really cool concept, and I think they're hopefully going to see some growth as time goes on. But they had this really fun mechanic of basically kind of a game of chicken. So you would have these Void Runners, who were the these spaceships that were shipping cargo from one point to another. And then you would have the ports that they would be shipping the cargo to. And the port holders were, the players would actually buy a port or a space station. They would, that's where the cargo would go to and be distributed. But oftentimes they would change the game mechanic would change the rules of who could be at what port, what cargo could be shipped, what type of ships could offload. So you might find yourself suddenly set up as an illegal ship and not able to offload, but you could continue to do it legally. And so you're making money, you're offloading your cargo from the ship, but the port owner could choose to confiscate your cargo. So it was kind of an interesting balance of how long do you stay at this port legally and make money by offloading your cargo for the port owner. They could come in there and just confiscate everyone's cargo right away, but then people wouldn't go to that port or that star base because they knew it was very, they'd be very quickly confiscated if they were illegal. So people would go to other ones that were a little more lenient, and that very strict port wouldn't make money. So there's this really kind of cool mechanic there of, do you punish people for the, trying to push the limits, or do you let them go break the rules yourself to allow more revenue for your port? So I think that was a super, super fun mechanic. And it was a player versus player thing where you were, really having people focused on this game of chicken. I thought that was really awesome.
It's something that has caught my eye a lot is the concept of massive interactive live events, or MILES. And so essentially the idea here is you have this ongoing kind of stream or broadcast that is going on for a long period of time. It's a little bit of a combination between a TV show, but with some gaming elements, where individuals are able to have some small role in impacting the outcome of this overall kind of broadcast or event. So for an example of this, The Walking Dead did one of these. So I believe they had this going for, it was like weeks or months of this ongoing story that they had kind of reoccurring updates to the story over time about what is happening to the different characters, kind of sort of like reality TV show like for some of these versions. And so you kind of, there's uncertainty about what will happen, who will survive. But then players are able to impact the story. I believe the mechanic they used was some classic casual game, like match three or something, mechanics to earn points, and then you're able to leverage those towards making an impact. Something along the lines that you're able to vote on an outcome, or maybe name a character after yourself. Some things along this line where it's a bit more passive than a lot of other game experiences, a little bit closer to kind of consuming a TV show, but just like you get really, like you might follow a really engaging TV show, there's another added layer to it when you feel like you're able to contribute and impact the outcome, even if it's only in a small way. And that's something where I'm really curious to see how this can be further expanded upon with Web3 components. So what is the impact of this? If there's ownership, maybe you have an NFT that represents a certain character and you want to, and that just continues to raise the stakes and your enjoyment and engagement of that particular mile. So yeah, definitely interested to see where innovation goes with that mechanic.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't see any of that. I had to tap out of Walking Dead after they killed off Glenn.
Yeah, never actually seen The Walking Dead myself, but get around to it.
Yeah, quality's gone down quite a bit. So we talked a lot about modern games and, you know, this innovation in modern games. And while we're in a Web3 space, we are talking about blockchain technology. So how can game developers leverage blockchain technology to create more secure, transparent, and innovative game economy?
Yeah, so something that I thought was really cool here, and I gave a little teaser for it at the beginning, but the Curio team building out one of they're trying to iterate a bunch of different types of on-chain games to test what works and what doesn't. And so they came out with something called Treaties. And essentially what this enabled is user-generated game logic. So anyone has the ability to create this kind of treaty or agreement on-chain and then have it be an enforceable game mechanic. And so like an example of this would be that you agree to a truce with another player. You form a non-aggression treaty with another player. And then this, since this is a fully on-chain game, you are programmatically restricted from attacking that other player. And so this kind of tackles areas where you previously might have to deal with trust issues of what happens if someone breaks a contract or breaks a treaty and you need some other type of enforcement mechanism for it. But in this case, you don't. You're able to create these complex agreements. This can go much farther past just the idea of aggression. It could have it in financial components of, I will only trade with a certain person to create embargoes, or I will only or agree on certain type of pricing for something, and just create all these interesting components that they don't have to come from the game developer. This can all come up from the communities. You could have different alliances that are coming up with their own kind of internal strategies on how they're going to create these innovative types of treaties that will give them an edge in their research here and agreements. So really interested to see how that develops as well in terms of getting these on-chain games that are innovating with enforceable on-chain game logic.
Interesting. Go ahead, Fuzzroll.
I was just saying, I think that's a really great insight there.
Yeah. And today we mentioned a lot of different protocols and different games and different kind of stuff. Just, we don't have any skin in the game in any of these. We're not promoting them. We're not working with them. We're just knowledge sharing. So just FYI. Okay, lastly, everyone is talking about AI today. And everybody's talking about AI. What impact do you see with AI and machine learning when it comes to in-game economy? Because I'm very interested in this.
That's a great question. I think, you know, to be honest, no one's really sure yet. I think it's, you know, AI is still very early, obviously, in the development here. But honestly, you know, I think where AI is at, I think right now today is the worst that AI is going to be. And it will only get better from here and it will only get more advanced and more, innovative. I think you'll see a lot of, developers kind of turn to it for more of their creative content, coming up with ideas that maybe they didn't have. They'll feed in models from games that they liked or other competitors' games to try to distill out maybe insights that they hadn't seen in those other games. So I think that, you know, using it as a tool for competitive analysis would be something that I would see developers turning to.
Yeah, and one of the things that comes to mind for me on this is, for the actual creation of games, AI tooling is going to make things a lot easier. So this is going to lower the barrier to entry for game creation. So that increases competition in the market for content. And so in that way, it's we are seeing like greater ability for people to monetize their work, like with the more recent Fortnite 2.0 direct revenue share to creators, and hopefully in a Web3 direction, we'll get more even larger shares of revenue for content creation to the creators themselves. But at the same time, with AI having this greater competition of lower, given those lower barriers to entry, that might also that'll be interesting to see, because that might kind of drive down the potential revenue given the really large supply increase in the content itself. It'll be a quality versus quantity trade-off to some extent, though. But yeah, we'll see how that goes and what impact that will have on people's ability to do this professionally, and if maybe it'll go towards smaller entities, but time will tell on that. And then the other component is it's going to be easier to create bots. So there's any opportunity for value extraction within an economy. If now it's you don't need to have a strong coding background in order to create those potentially at this point. And it's even with the ability to analyze visual components, it just seems to be getting easier and easier to create whatever is needed to exploit a particular opportunity. So a lot more will need to be done from the incentive design perspective of thinking about how open to extraction or exploitability is a particular game economy, and how can that be tackled from an incentive perspective versus solely a technical perspective. As the with AI, the botters are gaining a very significant tool. There's also potential for the counter of that of anti-AI metrics, but it's always a game of cat and mouse in terms of the technical battle between the two on. And so, yeah, it'll really drive up the importance of good incentive design on different types of distribution of anything that is supposed to have value in that economy.
So I love that you both came from different perspectives, you know, with AI and economy. The good thing about AI is that we can create a lot more measurement, maintenance, monitoring so that we can improve the economy. We can even use AI to tell us how to improve the economy. At the same time, AI can be exploiting the way we design economy because they're much, much more informed of how to exploit different kinds of systems, especially when we build systems for exploitation. And there's a threat over there. And it's a good balance of understanding the opportunities and threats that AI can bring as we move in this new innovative space. So as we have the last 4 minutes, I just want to conclude everything that we've talked about today. And we're talking about understanding the building blocks of game economies. We spoke about three topics. We spoke about mechanics, constraints, and innovation. In mechanics, we discussed the various good game design and good game mechanics. Why are they good? We talked about the difference between user acquisition mechanics and user retention mechanics, because they're going to be key. They're not the same for all user types. And how do we balance between the incentives and mechanics for getting more people on board and incentive and mechanics for people to stay in the system? We also talked about the constraints in place, the different kind of technological constraints, the different kind of user constraints, the different kind of feedback constraints. For example, we want to have a decentralized space and get people to vote. At the same time, whales can have huge voting power and they skew the results or they skew the economy changes to benefit just them at the expense of everyone, the zero-sum game. So how do we balance these constraints when building economies and maintaining economies? Lastly, we talked about the various innovation in the space. We talked about three different kinds of innovation. One, just game innovation in general. Any new ideas, new mechanics in traditional games as a whole. We also talked about how DLT, how blockchain can come in and help with innovation in the space. And lastly, we concluded with AI, because that's the thing that everyone is talking about. How AI can come into the space, how AI can commingle with blockchain technology and help us to build better economies or become a threat to the economies that we're building. So thank you, Rob and Hifa, for this chat. It was very interesting. And do you guys have any last words you want to say before we say goodbye to everyone?
I would just like to say, thank you very much for having me join the team here. I have had quite a crash course here over the past few weeks, joining the company, immediately heading off to a massive convention. And, I have to say the people were all very, very interested in the type of work they were doing. And so I'm very excited for what's to come.
Yeah. So thanks to everybody for joining the space. If my DMs are always open, if anyone wants to chat about economics or has any questions or suggestions for future spaces, future topics they'd like to hear us talk about, or if you happen to have any projects where you might want some help with design your economy, happy to chat in DMs.
Absolutely. Well, thank you everyone for joining. Our DMs are always open. Feel free to chat up with us with anything. And we try to schedule our Twitter spaces every month so we can share the new interesting research that we have discovered, the new insights that we have been looking into in the past entire month, and share it with you guys. So with that, thank you, Rob. Thank you, Keeper. Thank you, everyone else who joined us. And we'll speak to you next month. Bye-bye.